loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe announced this morning that the fuel tax that set off rioting around the country will be suspended for 6 months. The yellow vest protests have grown to include other issues, however, reflecting widespread anger at President Macron for his failure to improve living standards. Next, former President George H.W. Bush died over the weekend at the age of 94. His body is currently lying in state in the U.S. Capitol, and a funeral will take place tomorrow. We'll look at the Bush presidency and the Bush legacy each day this week, focusing on a different issue. Today, we'll talk about his role in the coup that overthrew Haiti's democratically elected government in 1991. Then, the European Court of Justice's Advocate General delivered a non-binding opinion yesterday that the UK could arbitrarily cancel its decision to withdraw from the European Union if it so chose. The decision comes as the House of Commons begins a week of debate on Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan, and Parliament found the government in contempt this morning for not issuing Brexit advice. And then Israel's military says that it has begun an operation to destroy what it calls cross-border attack tunnels under its border with Lebanon dug by Hezbollah operatives. An Israeli government spokesman said the tunnels had only recently been detected and they will be destroyed without having to cross the border into Lebanon. But is this, in fact, motivated by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's legal and political problems at home? And finally, Nexstar Media Group announced yesterday that it will buy Tribune Corporation's 42 television stations and its cable network in an all-cash $4.1 billion deal. An earlier takeover attempt by Sinclair Media was blocked by the Federal Communications Commission. If approved, the company will own more than 200 television stations covering 39% of all American households. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe announced this morning that the fuel tax that set off rioting around the country will be suspended for 6 months. The yellow vest protests have grown to include other issues, however, reflecting widespread anger at President Macron for his failure to implement reforms. We're joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. Good to have you back again, Gilbert.
Thank you for having me, guys.
A lot has changed since we talked to you yesterday. What's going on?
Actually, a lot has changed.
A lot has changed.
But the as you pointed out, there were a moratorium, a freeze on the price of gas. But various gilets jaunes and even people at the parliament, at the Assemblée nationale, said about the announcement of Edouard Philippe. C'est trop peu et trop tard. It's too little, too late. And it's just they are reacting with an incredible, it's kind of blame. And it's also, it coincides curiously. It was not completely limited to, I have to be honest with Edouard Philippe. He also announced that the a planned increase on electricity and gas would not happen up until, curiously enough, and it's not a coincidence, the European election in May. So it's kind of, it's not going to diffuse anything. The reaction at the Assemblée Nationale was completely less than lukewarm to the announcement. It was hostile. It's sort of like what's pretty funny in French politics. They can feel the pulse of the public opinion, and if they feel like the public opinion is really mad, they kind of capture it in their own way. But Edouard Philippe said, and I have to mention that. It's a translation of it, of course. He said in a way that was, sort of tone deaf. But this is what he said. This anger, you would be deaf or blind not to hear it. I measure its force, its gravity. This anger finds its origin in a deep injustice. You know, so he's sort of saying something that people want to hear, but again, the concrete measure that the Gilets Jaunes are expecting, which are numerous. I mean, it's, for example, we didn't go through that yesterday with you guys, to raise the minimum wages to 1,300 euro a month. What people have to understand in the U.S. is that since the crash of 2008, there's been austerity measure in France. And if the economy has sort of, you know, revived, the salary of people have not increased. So with an inflation of between 2 or 3% a year in 10 years, well, that's they lost in the buying power. They lost about, 25-30%. And also as an idea, because I don't think people in the U.S. realize what it's all about here. As an idea, the price of gas in France per gallon, the equivalent of the gallon price of gas would be $5.60 a gallon, and that's more than two times the price of gas in the U.S. And the Gilets Jaunes are fully aware that Macron and his government are lying, because out of that money, of course, the price of crude is the same pretty much everywhere. 64% is in tax, okay, from the French government. But it's supposed to finance what they call the transition écologique, which is the ecological, you know, the Minister of the Environment and Ecology. But only 20% of that revenue of that 64% finance that. So people understand that they are really, truly getting screwed. They're getting taken for a ride.
We're joined by Gilbert Mercier, who is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and also the author of The Orwellian Empire. Brian, I see a lot of parallels here with 1968. 1968 was about... it was about war, it was about education, and it morphed into other issues. I think Gilbert will agree with me that we're seeing the same thing here. This isn't just about fuel prices.
Exactly. And also the French are teaching us a lesson, which is, I would say, distinctly French. I mean, if you go back through the past 200 plus years, starting with the French Revolution, which sort of brought Europe out of the Middle Ages and brought sort of the end of the era of kings and queens. It was the beginning of the end of feudalism and the whole idea of the rights of man, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, a tremendous leap forward for humanity. That was a consequence of French radicalism, the French Revolution. Yes, it was a very violent affair, but it brought the masses into motion. And when you go back through the past couple centuries, this is a distinctive feature of French politics. We had these disruptions happening across the country, and yet 72% of the people in France supported these protests. The French obviously want to have an ecologically sound society, but here you have the elites imposing fuel taxes on working people who can't afford them. And most of those new taxes aren't to make France greener. They're to pay for other things. And who gets hurt? I mean, this is a class-based society. Working class and poor workers are getting hurt. And they see in these reforms and they see in Macron's policies something that's very, not just foreign to them, but is actually demonstrably harmful to them. So they go into the streets. And what they're teaching us, because American workers have also lost a lot. Other German workers, other workers have lost a lot. The French are teaching us a lesson. If you want to win, you have to go to the street.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Brian. And it's the lesson, and that revolution are quickly forgotten, and they always need revolution. They need to be freshened up at some point. And the thing is, people are saying, oh, the violence, the casseurs, the vandals, it's horrible. They're breaking those beautiful things, symbol of the Republic. Yes, but the very precise Republic was built on the guillotine and the blood of aristocrats and destroying Versailles. And that happened very quickly. Well, right now, what we don't have the Danton, the Saint-Just, the Mirabeau, the Robespierre of the time. But It is teaching, it should be teaching everybody a lesson, and especially in the U.S., because General Motors just announced that they would cut 60,000 jobs very, very soon.
Exactly. The workers there need to go on strike because right now that's the only way to save their jobs. Go ahead. Sorry for interrupting.
Sears is closing down, completely bankrupt. The CEO is taking all the money while everybody is going to be out of a job. 68,000 people. I mean, people have to understand, again, like I mentioned yesterday on your guys' show, this is the failure of neoliberalism. What Macron is sort of like the Chicago boy, like Milton Friedman neoliberalism. That's what he is, okay? Let's not forget that Macron, before to work in government, was a commercial banker at Rothschild. So he doesn't understand certain interests, the interest of finance, the interest of Wall Street. It is failing. It is failing all of us. It is failing all of us everywhere.
Gilbert is right, John.
Yes.
Gilbert is right because, and see, that's the thing is when a spark is lit where people start to fight back, and of course they're demonized. If this was happening in the U.S., these protesters would be thoroughly demonized by the mainstream media. But when people fight back, and if the French teach us we can win, then guess what? American workers could look over there and say, hey, the French did this and they won. What do we need? We need job security. We need decent wages. We need health care. If we're not going to get it through the ballot box, we go to the street or we go on strike. That's the lesson.
That is it. We were joined by Gilbert Mercier. He's the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Former President George H.W. Bush died over the weekend at the age of 94. His body will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol, and a funeral will take place tomorrow on Wednesday. We're taking a look at the Bush presidency and the Bush legacy each day this week, focusing on different issues. Today, we're going to continue a discussion we started yesterday about the role of the Bush administration in the overthrow of the progressive government of Haiti in 1991. We're joined again from New York City by Kim Ives. He is an editor of the newspaper Haiti Liberté. Kim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Kim, you were there, meaning you were part of the movement to liberate Haiti from the dictatorship, from the Duvalier dictatorship, the U.S.-backed Duvalier dictatorship. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, progressive priest, took power, became the president, and no sooner had he taken power than it appeared that Haitian elites, with the support of the Bush administration, moved to topple that progressive government. Just talk about what actually happened and why it happened.
Well, it was a fascinating period in that a lot of the world was sort of depressed that you'd seen the Sandinistas had their power taken away through basically a U.S.-backed electoral coup in 1990. You saw the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so there was this tremendous sense of empowerment that came with Haitians electing this liberation theologian, progressive priest on December 16th, 1990. And this was really the first time that U.S. election engineering in Latin America had been foiled by the people. That is, across the continent, many elections were happening like they do here. The candidate with the most money wins. And in fact, the U.S. candidate was a guy called Marc Bazin, who was a former World Bank economist. He had a war chest of about $36 million against Aristide's $500,000 put up by an anti-imperialist Palestinian Haitian businessman named Antoine Ismarie. And so even outgunned 72-1, Aristide won that election to the absolute amazement of the U.S. In fact, President former President Jimmy Carter was there at the time and tried to have them give it to Bazin anyway. But the Haitian people poured out in the streets, and this was a period of tremendous hope and joy. But immediately, the U.S. government, headed by George H.W. Bush, set about undoing this. And they started with a campaign called Democracy Enhancement, ironically, you know, always these opposite named operations. And the Democracy Enhancement Project was essentially a way to politically undermine this government. And they started to build opposition forces in the parliament, et cetera, and create a fire underneath this new embryonic Aristide government. And over the next 8 months, essentially, at the beginning of 91, the government came into power on February 7th, 1991. Aristide declared it Haiti's second independence because they were going to finally try to pry Haiti out of the grips of the U.S. imperialism, not to be a U.S. neo-colony anymore. And so they gradually turned up the heat up until September 30th, 1991, when the army staged a very bloody coup, as we discovered in a second delegation by the Haiti Commission of Inquiry into the coup d'etat in Haiti with Ramsey Clark. That night of September 30th, there were some 500 to 800 people who were machine gunned in front of the palace. People poured out in the streets trying to stop the coup, but the U.S. backed Haitian military and police came out and mowed them down. During the course of the 3 years of the coup, that is from 1991 to 1994, it was estimated that some 5,000 Haitians were killed. And this was all under George H.W. Bush. Originally, they had, in the face of world outrage at the beginning, they had said, oh, well, this coup is not sanctioned by us and it will not stand. Those were the very words of James Baker, then Secretary of State. But within a week, the administration started to change its tune, and they said that, in fact, Aristide had brought the coup upon himself. Worse than that, they set up a blockade around Haiti, intercepting all the Haitians who were fleeing this terror that was established in the country. And they put all the refugees in a concentration camp, basically terrible conditions in tents in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, a base which the U.S., despite Cuba's requests, has always maintained. Cuba has always refused the U.S. rent payments for it as a matter of principle. And they put the Haitians in these camps. Eventually, most of them were sent back to Haiti, but they did keep there a number who were HIV positive in a camp called Camp Bulkley, which was infested with banana rats and flies. It was just hell on earth. I visited it twice. And they essentially put these 300 Haitian HIV-positive refugees in this camp and held them there under just terrible conditions. At one point, there was a Congress person, I forget his name, who said, what does it matter? They're going to die anyway. I mean, this was the cynicism under the George H.W. Bush administration towards these Haitian refugees whose flight they had caused by carrying out this coup d'etat against Aristide.
Do Haitians remember the role of George H.W. Bush? I mean, I can remember so vividly that the huge, as you put it, optimism. It was really a euphoric moment that while the rest of the world was kind of going in the opposite direction of social justice, you had the Haitians who, in spite of all odds, because under Duvalier, you were up against all odds, the Tantan Macoutes carrying out huge massacres of people, I mean, going through markets, just slaughtering people. I mean, literally slaughtering people, chopping people up in the public streets. In spite of all that, this progressive movement comes to power under Aristide. And immediately, the elites, the reactionaries, the thugs of the old regime and their buds in Washington, D.C. start to undermine, in the name of enhancing democracy, try to undermine democracy. Do the Haitian people remember this?
Well, I think they do. And of course, we're going to remind them this week in Haiti Liberté. We'll devote our reporting to remembering in a very different light the administration of George H.W. Bush, which eventually, you know, that was also what helped lose him the election, apparently, in 92 against Clinton. Clinton said that, well, these Haitians who were being held would be allowed into the U.S. and they would be able to get asylum, et cetera. Typically, Clinton, he immediately reversed himself even before he was inaugurated, saying, no, no, they're going to have to stay there in Guantanamo or be sent back to Haiti. But George W. Bush, you know, this was a real war criminal. I mean, beginning with Panama, going through what he did in Haiti, and then, of course, the terrible slaughter he carried out in Iraq, including of so many civilians. I think the legacy, this unctuous, absolutely outrageous presentation of this quote-unquote genial president really has to be put in that perspective.
Kim Ives, what's the situation now in Haiti? We have 90 seconds left. I mean, ever since there was the coup, then Aristide came back, with the U.S. military bringing him back, but with very, very diminished powers, almost no powers. All the time that he had been sacked through the coup d'etat, that was considered a time that had already been served. Aristide runs again. I mean, it's been up and down and up and down, so many trials and tribulations for the people in Haiti. What's it like now? 1 minute left.
Well, the situation is very dire. Haiti is in the midst of a revolution right now. The people are rising up against the government of Jovenel Moïse, who is essentially a neo-Duvalierist president who was brought to power by the U.S., and as was his predecessor, Michel Martelly. These have been mafia governments, I could say, who embezzled most of about $4 billion of a solidarity fund provided Haiti by Venezuela through an arrangement called the Petrocaribe Accord, which gave Haiti cheap oil with a capital fund, which was essentially plundered by these PHTK governments. And now the people are rising up, and within the coming weeks and months, we may well see the government have to step down and a provisional government come into place. So, you know, this is really the result both of the George H.W. Bush government and his son, George W. Bush, in 1991 and 2004, respectively. They were the ones who carried out these coups, and now the people are responding again.
That's all the time we have. We were joined from New York City by Kim Ives. Kim is an editor of the newspaper Haiti Liberté. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The European Court of Justice's Advocate General delivered a non-binding opinion yesterday that the UK could arbitrarily cancel its decision to withdraw from the European Union if it so chose. The decision comes as the House of Commons begins a week of debate on Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan, and Parliament found the government in contempt this morning for not issuing Brexit advice. We're joined from London by Steve Headley. He's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Welcome back, Steve.
Thank you for the invite.
Steve, I want to start with this announcement of contempt. Apparently, it's the first time in British history that a government has been held in contempt of Parliament. Why is it that these ministers would not fully brief their colleagues on Brexit?
Yeah, what they've actually been found in contempt of is refusing to share the full legal advice that they got on Brexit. And I think that this is the first time it's ever happened. In Britain, we have a parliamentary system where Parliament runs the country. You have a thing called parliamentary sovereignty. And the government have completely ignored that parliamentary sovereignty by refusing to share with the rest of Parliament the full legal advice that they got in on Brexit and its implications.
And why would they do that? Is it because they don't like the advice that they would be compelled to give?
Well, I think it blows out of the water the illusion that they can just go off and do trade deals all over the world. The fact that the European Union will still have, in a lot of cases, a veto on what Britain can do. Although Britain will not now have a voice within the European Union, won't have a seat at the table, it'll still be bound by a lot of the decisions. And I think that if that advice became clear, then people would more and more argue that we haven't really got a Brexit situation. We've got a situation where Britain has ceded rights within the European Union, but still de facto remains a part of the European Union.
Let's talk a little bit about this European Court of Justice opinion. It's non-binding, but it seems awfully compelling. Now, this was done at the request of some Scottish MPs who are opposed to Brexit. And what it says is that if the British government wanted to, it could just stop the whole Brexit process right now and just go back to the way things were, or hold another referendum, or essentially do whatever it wants. Is there any real chance of that happening?
I think there's an increasing chance, and I think that Theresa May, the left of her party, the Remainers, and the right wing of her party, the Brexiteers, are going to vote against her deal en masse, or at least are threatening to. She's already lost the support of the DUP over the issue of the backstop for Ireland. So I think it's going to go down in Parliament. That looks like the case now, unless she can pull a rabbit out of the hat.
Well, let's talk about that, too, because she's been not very good at pulling rabbits out of hats. At least in the last election, she wasn't very good at it. So there are a couple of different scenarios here. She could lose the confidence of her own party, in which case, unless there are defections, a new prime minister would be chosen from the Conservative Party. Or she could lose a vote of no confidence and have to call new elections. Are there any other scenarios that we're looking at? And what do you think is the most likely thing to happen?
I think that there's going to be she's threatening that if her plan isn't backed, then the alternative is no deal or no Brexit. And there are MPs who are now using what's happened to the European Court to strengthen their case that there shouldn't be a Brexit at all. So I mentioned the words that as being the position in both parties are going to use this as an opportunity to scupper Brexit and perhaps go for a so-called people's referendum. I really see that as the most likely alternative.
That would be pretty dramatic if that were to happen. Yeah. And the markets, I think the markets would be very interested in such a thing. What's the likelihood, do you think?
I really think it's probably about a 60-40 now that that's going to happen. I think just on the news that the European Court of Justice came up with this advice, the pound has actually strengthened.
Yes.
Against the euro and the dollar. So that's something that they're looking for in an economic terms as advantageous to Britain. But I think that unless there's a no-deal Brexit, the concept that people actually voted on Brexit is dead, because May's deal really is the worst of all worlds. You're bound by European regulations and you can't influence them.
At the time that Brexit was being voted on, at the time of the referendum, really all the talk, all the debate was about the National Health Service and how there would be such a monumental savings by pulling out of the European Union that money could be better spent on healthcare. Everybody would be happy and it would be free and everybody would be healthy. And that's just not worked out. That's not what it's been. So in the event that it goes to referendum again, or there's a vote forced of no confidence, regardless of whether May wins or loses, what does this do for Jeremy Corbyn and for his standing in the European Union?
Well, I mean, I think Corbyn is probably going to be elected as the leader of a government pretty soon. It looks like the indications are going that way. I don't think the DUP are going to prop up May any longer. I think what Corbyn will inherit, if he becomes Prime Minister, is an absolute mess. I mean, the negotiations that May has conducted have been absolutely shocking. They're completely in favor of the European Union and not advantageous to Britain at all. So I think unless Corbyn actually says that he's prepared to do a no-deal Brexit, then the alternatives are this. If there's a no-deal Brexit, there's May's worse than staying in the European Union, or you scrap the whole project and just remain part of the European Union. Now, what Jeremy Corbyn would decide to do, I don't know, but there's increasing voices within the right of his own party to say, scrap leaving the European Union together, have a second referendum, which opinion polls are saying that people would vote remain in big numbers to stay within the European Union. And I think that would be a likely scenario facing a Corbyn government.
Yeah, Jeremy Corbyn has always been what would be called a Eurosceptic, meaning that not against the integration or solidarity between the peoples of continental Europe and the UK, but under this particular neoliberal super capitalist arrangement whereby unions, working people, and countries lose control over their own destiny because you have centralized bureaucrats who are loyal to centralized and monopoly banking and corporate interests making decisions that no country can escape from, even if their popular elected representatives listen to their own people and do otherwise. So we're in a situation where if Jeremy Corbyn inherits the position of the government with the collapse of Theresa May and the Tories, and under these circumstances, and given the fact that there are right-wing, you know, elites within the Labour Party who are gunning for him, even though there's a lot of idealism and optimism and hope with Jeremy Corbyn, either way, it's a rough road, it would seem to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, people have got very short memories. They would forget that the Conservatives led them to this path, and they would blame Corbyn for the wreckage that would ensue, that we're now facing with the absolute kind of non-Brexit that's on the table. I think that perhaps that's a strategy of the Conservative Party, because whoever's left holding the baby after these negotiations really will be unelectable for 10 or 15 years.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, you could easily see why at a certain point, and given the fact that it's going to be either Labour or the Conservative Party that takes the helm, under certain circumstances, someone might prefer the other party to be the incumbent party. Labour, and you're, of course, a leader in Labour, Steve Hedley. Labour, it seems to me, has to chart its own path, have its own voice. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I mean, my trade union's not affiliated to the Labour Party. We're an independent trade union. We do support Jeremy Corbyn, and we do support the leadership of the Labour Party. We don't support the right wing in the Labour Party. That's why we refuse to reaffiliate. But we think that whatever happens, the trade union movement's going to be absolutely pivotal, because in the event of a no deal, we're going to have a situation where we're going to be the forces on wages will be pressing downwards, forces on working class people's living standards will be forcing downwards. Similarly, if we have if we accept what's on offer with the Theresa May deal, then living standards will be attacked and wages will be attacked as well. So the trade unions, the independence of trade unions and the willingness of trade unions to fight back for the needs of the working class is going to be absolutely vital.
We will leave it there. We were joined from London by Steve Hedley. He's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Israel's military says it has begun an operation to destroy what it calls cross-border attack tunnels under its border with Lebanon, dug by Hezbollah operatives. An Israeli government spokesman said the tunnels had only recently been detected and they will be destroyed without having to cross the border into Lebanon. But is this in fact motivated by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's legal and political problems at home? We're joined from Washington by Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko also has a new book out called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Welcome back, Miko.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Miko, there are tunnels all over Gaza. Now there are tunnels underneath the border from Lebanon. It's hardly newsworthy when tunnels are found. Is this really about a recommendation to indict Netanyahu?
Of course. I think Netanyahu, when Lieberman, the previous defense minister, resigned, he handed Netanyahu a wonderful gift, which is the Ministry of Defense. And now Netanyahu is defense minister as well as many other things. But being defense minister allows him to parade and to portray himself as this military expert. You know, he's always troubled and worried and dealing with important military and security issues. And when you compare that and all these important security threats, all these terrible security threats that Israel has to deal with some small corruption charges, I mean, it doesn't add up. It's not worth dealing with. So now, of course, whereas yesterday, if you looked at the Israeli papers, there was still some mention of the corruption charges. Today, it's all southern Lebanon. It's all Hezbollah. It's all pictures of Netanyahu with his senior security staff, with the generals, and so forth. So this is a great PR and political gift that he got when Lieberman resigned, and now he's making use of it. And of course, the police chief who recommended that Netanyahu be indicted was just fired. So in other words, this was his last day in office, and now, you know, the attorney general has to decide whether to indict or not, and who's going to indict a prime minister who's engaged in such important work for the security of the state of Israel. So it's all politics.
And, you know, on top of that, Netanyahu, being prime minister, has also appointed himself, as Miko said, defense minister, but he's also foreign minister and communications minister. He's half the Israeli government, practically. It's all concentrated into the hands of this one man.
Right. Orly Noy, who is a wonderful Israeli writer and journalist, said that now when Netanyahu needs to get his cabinet together, there are no scheduling problems because he can sit by himself and have all the meetings he wants. He doesn't need to schedule with anybody else because he holds all these portfolios, the defense, the foreign affairs, and the communications. So, yeah, it's ridiculous, but it allows him a lot of wonderful PR and a lot of political maneuvering. And he does it all very, very well, to a point where indicting him seems extremely unlikely.
Miko Peled is our guest. Miko is the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He's also the author of a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko Peled, there was a war between Israel and Lebanon in 2006, in the summer of 2006. Talk a little bit for the audience who may not have been politically aware at that time or old enough at that time to understand what that conflict is or was about, how that war ended, and just your own sense of whether it's possible that in spite of this being mainly a political stunt for Netanyahu and to bolster his situation domestically, is there a possibility of a greater conflict again with Lebanon?
I don't think so. I don't think that Netanyahu wants a serious conflict. He needs headlines. A serious conflict in Lebanon would involve bombing and destroying southern Lebanon once again, which is what they did in 2006, like you said. And there were, I don't know, close to a million refugees who became homeless. It was a disaster. They can't afford to put in ground troops because last time they brought in ground troops, the Hezbollah ground troops were far better fighters, and they kicked them out of southern Lebanon. The Israeli special forces, Israeli ground troops ran out literally with their tails between their legs. So nobody wants that. Nobody, I'm sure Netanyahu doesn't want that. But headlines are great. Talking about this new threat from the north is very helpful. They just got rid of this one threat or ended this one threat in the south, so now they need something else. So they've got this threat in the north. Once again, you got pictures of Netanyahu, defense minister, sitting with the generals. The headlines are all about how the cabinet led by Netanyahu is sitting together, whether or not he's going to call reservists. I mean, that's now the conversation. Nobody talks about these small potato issues like corruption. But I don't think anybody's planning. This is not going to lead to an actual attack of southern Lebanon. That would be absolute madness.
So tell me about these bribery and corruption accusations against Netanyahu. Is he just kicking the can down the road, or are these things just going to go away?
I'm guessing they're probably going to go away, because what's going to happen if he's probably going to end his term which I think has about a year to go, and then go to elections. And then he can say, well, the elections are the referendum. If people don't trust me, they're not going to vote for me. And everything, all the polls, I mean, all the signs are that if there were elections, whether now or a year from now, Netanyahu has really no challengers. Nobody can challenge him because of all of his accomplishments as prime minister, his accomplishments as foreign minister, the great relations that Israel has with African countries. They just had a meeting with Chad, with Arab leaders. He was in the Gulf himself. Things are looking great. The economy is good. Everybody seems to be very happy. So there's really nobody that can challenge Netanyahu politically. So I think he's doing the smart thing by waiting it out and then saying, well, once there's elections, then we'll see what the people say. And I don't think there's any doubt in his mind that he's going to win. And he's right. I think if there were elections, then he will win. And he will win big.
I have to say, too, whether you like Netanyahu or hate Netanyahu, the man is a master politician. I think he's the longest serving prime minister in Israeli history. Is that right, Miko?
He is. And I think short of perhaps David Ben-Gurion, who actually established the state of Israel, he is probably, in terms of accomplishments, he's the one with the most accomplishments to show. The Jerusalem Declaration, the moving of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem is an enormous accomplishment. And every single Israeli will attest, will seize it as such. I mean, this is a huge thing. The fact that the U.S. pulled out of the Iran deal when the only person that suggested, that advised the president of the United States to pull out is Netanyahu, and he's the only one he listened to, is enormous. Ending support for the UN refugee agency, UNRWA, it's a huge accomplishment. And he did all this really basically on his own. These are all really important achievements, and Israelis see them as important achievements. And there's nobody on the political arena in Israel who could even come close in terms of being an accomplished person, an accomplished team. So, I mean, there's nobody that can challenge him.
Miko Peled is our guest. He is the author of The General Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, the author of a new book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. In our last 2 minutes, Miko, I want to turn to a different subject. Your thoughts about the firing by CNN of Mark Lamont Hill, because he dared to say in the context of black politics at the United Nations, not on air, that the Palestinian struggle had many similarities to the black movement in America for civil rights, for equal rights, for liberation. What's your take about this firing? What does it show?
Well, it shows that the Zionists panic every time somebody talks about Palestinian rights, in particular when they talk about from the river to the sea. Well, Palestine is from the river to the sea. There is no other Palestine. So when people talk about Palestine, they talk about from the river to the sea. And of course, all the Zionists from CNN to Fox to, you know, all the trolls on social media. And I just wrote about this in the press. It came out today. You know, they panic when they hear this, and their gut reaction, and maybe it's not a gut reaction. I think maybe it's a strategy to say, aha, you see, this is genocide. This means the killing of all Jews. Or, of course, it's not. It just means that everybody who lives from the river to the sea should live free and enjoy the same rights. That's what it talks about. So it's a sign of that same hysteria. At the same time, I'll say, and this relates to Netanyahu too, I think every Israeli prime minister from this moment on, and this is, again, one of the, I think this comes out of this CNN firing Lamont, is any Israeli prime minister from this point on needs to know that he or she may well be the next de Klerk, and he or well may be the one forced to end the apartheid regime in Palestine.
De Klerk, of course, the last leader of apartheid South Africa before majority rule came again. Miko has written a lot, John, and I want to come back in another time to talk about there isn't going to be two states. There's one state, as Miko has pointed out over and over again. And the question is, will the one state be a democratic state or an apartheid state?
Right.
Will it be for all the people, or will it only be for one people or one religion? I mean, it's really just basically down to that.
It is, and we will leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and also of Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Nexstar Media Group announced yesterday that it will buy Tribune Corporation's 42 television stations and cable network in an all-cash $4.1 billion deal. An earlier takeover attempt by Sinclair Media was blocked by the Federal Communications Commission. If approved, the company will own more than 200 television stations covering 39% of all American households. We'll talk about that with Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press, and he joins us from Washington. Tim, welcome back.
Hi, how are you today?
Hey, Tim, isn't this exactly what the complaint about Sinclair was, that all this power in media was going to be concentrated in the hands of one company, and so Sinclair was denied, and now we have Nexstar making the purchase? What's the difference between the two?
Nexstar really just slipped into Sinclair's shoes once that deal went south and is really proposing to create a company of similar scale. You know, if this merger is approved, Nexstar would become the largest holder of broadcast licenses in the United States. And the reason that the Sinclair deal was ultimately denied is it was because there were a number of questions about the way it conducted its business. In particular, Sinclair created what are called shell companies with other broadcast owners. It would take over the sales and marketing. It would take over the news production of another license holder for a local television station, and it would basically run their business. And that was a way for it to avoid ownership limits. Congress has put in place, the FCC have put in place limits to how much television broadcasters a single company can hold. And so these shell companies were just a way to get around that. And not surprisingly, Nexstar has similar arrangements. So we hope that it goes under a similar level of scrutiny and ultimately the FCC denies this merger as well.
And what does this mean for consumers then, with fewer and fewer companies controlling larger and larger shares of the market?
Well, it means that you're going to get less diversity of opinion, less diversity of journalism over your local broadcast airwaves. These types of large mergers, and even when Nexstar announced this yesterday, they said that there will be synergies, economies of scale that result from these sorts of mergers. And every time an executive who's contemplating a merger says the word synergy, you should think layoffs. And that's what has happened in the past. They've shuttered local newsrooms, they've laid off local reporters, and they go with the kind of cookie-cutter style journalism that can be produced out of a central studio and then syndicated to their many local outlets. And if this deal is approved, there will be more than 200 local stations that are under Nexstar's control. And so that kind of synergy means less local news and information for people living in those communities. And I just want to reiterate why that's bad. It's because people tend to trust their local news sources more than they trust national news, more than they trust cable news networks. During elections, they look to local news to cover local issues that are on the ballot. And if that sort of localism gets leached out of your local television stations, then consumers suffer in multiple ways.
That's the voice of Tim Carr. Tim is the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at the organization Free Press, and he joins us from Washington. Your organization is called Free Press, but the press isn't free. Costs a lot of money to make these kind of super mergers. Only a few monopoly corporations are still here, Tim. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal. Again, I just want to summarize for our listeners what's happening. The proposed combination between Nexstar and Tribune Media would create the largest local TV station operator in the country. Nexstar owns, operates, or services 174 stations, while Tribune Media has 42. Tribune Media also owns the cable network WGN America and a 31% stake in TV Food Network. What we have then is one company, this will be Nexstar, having more than 200 stations, and right behind it, Sinclair, a right-wing owned media company that has almost as many, but not as many. So it's like, you know, it's really monopoly. It's not a free press.
It is a monopoly. And Tim makes an important point here, too. There's been a viral video making its way around Facebook and YouTube and Twitter about these dozens and dozens of stations, anchors at stations reading the same script that they've been given by their Sinclair overlords.
And the point of the video is to show us that none of this local news is actually local. It comes from Sinclair's headquarters, or in this case, it'll be Nexstar's headquarters. And we only get to hear, we only get to learn what these corporate giants want us to hear and to learn.
Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, so I mean, what's really important here is that, you know, the government in the United States, because of the First Amendment, can't regulate content. And that's a good thing, obviously. But what they can do is regulate ownership. And when it comes to use of the public airwaves, these television stations receive access to the public airwaves for free. Licenses are given out by the FCC for free. But so we have the power to regulate ownership or control of those airwaves. And one of the ways that you can create more voices and not fewer voices in the media and have more diversity of opinion, more diversity of news and information is by making sure that you don't hand all of those licenses to the same small handful of companies. And it is within the FCC's mandate to reject these types of mega mergers so that we can have multiple owners, so that we can have owners that actually live in the communities that they report about, so that they know what issues are at stake and they know the people who benefit from this sorts of news and information. So the FCC has really fallen down in that mandate over the last couple of decades. So one of the things that we do at Free Press is try to pressure that agency to live up to its central mandate, which is to promote diversity in use of the airwaves.
Tim, this is something that's going to have to go before the Justice Department antitrust division, and it's going to have to get government approval, government clearance. Will it? Or do you think that there's going to be a problem akin to what Sinclair experienced?
Well, I mean, Sinclair had a number of issues. There was pretty widespread popular outrage against Sinclair's use of must-run commentaries, where they mandated that all of their stations had to run commentary as part of their evening news program, and that commentary was often had a very far-right bias. Nexstar doesn't have as many political issues as Sinclair does, but the actual ownership structure that Nexstar is proposing, and the actual use of these sort of shell companies to help defray some of those ownership limits are still an issue here. And when the FCC decided to turn against the Sinclair proposal, it was not because of the political content that you and I and so many people are familiar with when it comes to Sinclair, but it was actually against this sort of ownership structure where they create these shell companies and ask them to run their own news or run Sinclair's news, but to retain their ownership license. And there's a real legal problem there that we at Free Press will be bringing up in hopes of scuttling this deal.
Tim Carr, I want our audience to sort of be, well, let's put it this way. I want our audience to learn what it is that they can do about this kind of thing. What does your organization do? Are there ways that people can support your organization? It's freepress.net. Are there things that people can do in their local communities? What should people do if you actually believe in the Free Press or a Free Press?
Well, one of the things that we're going to be doing is putting out information, more information on this deal, so you can find out whether you actually have a Nexstar station or a Tribune station in your community. So there are ways that you can act locally by writing letters to the editor or contacting your local stations and voicing your concern about this merger. But we'll also be putting forth information, comments at the FCC in an effort to have this deal rejected. And you can obviously go to freepress.net to find out more about that and how you can get more involved.
I was looking, they're projecting $160 million in savings. Tim talked about that before.
Well, you know where those savings are coming
what
from.
What does it mean to have $160 million in savings? Just a lot of people are going to lose their jobs and newsrooms are going to get shuttered or they're going to get streamlined so that actual local news content becomes non-existent, or it's just, you know, a thing or two a day. Meanwhile, it's all generated by these corporate giants. I think what's at issue really is not the First Amendment per se, because the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law, but it's actually the application or the spirit or the entitlement of actual free speech rights, because so many people rely on their local media. This is kind of a titanic moment, it seems to me, Tim Carr, and also perhaps we're at a fork in the road.
Well, we are. I mean, we've been fighting against media ownership for quite some time. But as you see more and more of these types of mergers go through, I think you realize that the problem that while a lot of people complain about the content that goes over these networks, and they have a right to do that, obviously, that a lot of the problem originates with just the structure of our media system in the United States, which has allowed for consolidated ownership in this way. And you know, if you look at it from a different perspective, you'll find that broadcast licenses, and both in radio and television, are given to companies that are largely owned by whites. There's very small minority ownership, license-holding local television stations. There's very small percentage of female ownership of these licenses. So there's a real problem in diversity issues. And, you know, one of the central mandates of the FCC is to promote competition, localism, and diversity over the airwaves. And if you're just handing out these licenses to the same small handful of companies, they're not fulfilling that central mandate.
Indeed. That was the voice of Tim Carr. Tim joined us from Washington. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. La 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 la